right, we are back on Wooden Sticks here on the Talk North Podcast Network. My name is Kevin Gorg, the host of the show. Super excited today to have a hockey conversation with one of my very favorites for the Minnesota North Stars back in the day, and then the Dallas Stars. Yes, Mike Modano, who works in the Wild organization, will be our guest today. I'll have the chance later in the show here to pick his brain on Kirill Kaprizov. And I think Mike has a unique perspective, being that he was the first overall pick in the 1988 draft and came to Minnesota with these big expectations of being this superstar to elevate this franchise. Kirill Kaprizov has dealt with that and done a pretty good job of being the go-to guy in Minnesota. So we'll get Mr. Modano's perspective on Kirill the Thrill. He grew up in Michigan. He debuted in the National Hockey League after being the first overall pick in the draft at a mere 18 years old. And for those of you that were around, you probably know what I'm about to tell you. For those of you that are a little bit younger and want to maybe go back in time when you come to Wooden Sticks, which is kind of the idea or the concept of this podcast, is this guy was Connor McDavid before Connor McDavid. There are rare players that come to the National Hockey League that actually get faster when they have the puck. Most slow down when they're trying to stick handle that puck and make plays and create space and get to the net. Mike Modano, like McDavid, would actually speed up with the puck. And I'm going to tell you, we're going to go back to this 1991 Cup run, a miraculous run by the North Stars, who barely got in the playoffs with 68 points, took out the President Cup winners in the Chicago Blackhawks, took out the number two team in the league, the St. Louis Blues with Brett Hull, and then faced the Edmonton Oilers, who were the defending Stanley Cup champions, had a guy named Grant Fuhr as their goaltender. Mark Messier was their captain. And Mike Modano scored a goal in that series at the Met Center that if we lived in an era back then that had social media, it would have blown Twitter or X or whatever platform you want to call, it would have blown it up into smithereens. He took the puck in his own end, waltzed through three different Oilers in the neutral zone, split the defenseman, and then the greatest goaltender of that era with four Stanley Cups in his hip pocket, he turned Grant Fuhr inside and out, put the puck in the net, and I swear to you, that's the loudest I've ever heard any arena at any time in my 50-plus years of being around the game of hockey. It was electric, to say the least, and that's Mike Modano, right? That's who this guy was. That jersey and that hair would be flapping in the breeze. He'd be flying around that Met Center. I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. In terms of U.S.-born hockey players, I dare you to find somebody better. And listen, I love Phil Housley. I hope to have Phil on the show here at some point on Wooden Sticks. But Mike Modano, for goals scored by a U.S.-born player, nobody more. 561. For points, top of the list, Modano, 1,374. He did that playing one game short of 1,500 games. He's in the Hockey Hall of Fame. His number nine is retired in Dallas. I was lucky enough to be working a Wild Dallas Stars game back in 2014 when Mike Modano's jersey went to the rafters in Dallas. And it was bittersweet for me, the North Star fan, but it was so cool to see and to be a part of that production. And just a couple months ago, they built the big statue and had the unveiling outside of the arena in Dallas. It's Dirk Nowitzki and it's Mike Modano. This guy's a rock star, man. I'm really looking forward to having this conversation. And as I mentioned, going back to the 90s, the cup run in 91 that fell just a little bit short against Lemieux and the Penguins. And then, yeah, let's give some love to the Dallas Stars, as much as that's going to suck. You know how I feel about the Dallas Stars, but it's Mike Modano and he's my guy. And in 1999, they get the job done against Dominic Hasek and the Buffalo Sabres. I believe in that series, and it came down to the very end, I think Mike Modano, who was playing with, I believe, a broken wrist, assisted on the last five goals scored for Dallas, including the Brett Hull series-clinching goal. So it'd be fun to hear Mike's perspective on all of that. Looking forward to this immensely, and we're going to have that hockey conversation with Mike Modano in mere minutes. Now, folks, when you think of the Freemasons, I'm sure you think of the secret handshakes and the unusual hats and, of course, those pancake breakfasts. But Minnesota Masonic Charities would prefer that you think about the work that they do right here in our community. Places like the Masonic Cancer Center at the University of Minnesota, the Masonic Children's Hospital, and of course, the Masonic Home over in Bloomington. They're just a few examples of the important work that Freemasons support here in Minnesota. is part of the largest fraternal organization in the world, Masons have consistently answered the call when it comes to charitable needs. I am happy that Minnesota Masonic Charities has chosen this podcast, Wooden Sticks, as a place to help spread the word. We look forward to learning more about the many programs in the weeks to come. Now, of course, we're going to have that chat with Mike Madonna. We're going to go back in time. I'm going to put him on the spot, too. I'm going to take him back to 21-year-old Mike Madonna. And I know that there were a lot of great bars and restaurants that welcomed those North Stars with open arms. And I'm certain they had some good times back during that cup run. If you want to have a good time, there's still a place to do it now in 2024. It's Beta Bay Boat Club. The weather is finally upon us, right? We've survived winter. Even though it was a mild winter, as Minnesotans, we have to look forward to spring and summer and make the most of the next few months. So why not give them a call at Beta Bay Boat Club, 952-401-3880. It's a country club boating experience, and there are memberships available now. It's so simple. Once you join, you just show up, hop on the boat, and have all kinds of fun. Entertain family and friends. Maybe it's a workouting, enjoying that weather out on Lake Minnetonka. It doesn't get much better. It's betabayboatclub.com. This is Wooden Sticks. I'm Kevin Gorg, and as promised, Hall of Famer Mike Madonna is next. Welcome back to Wooden Sticks. I'm Kevin Gorg, the host, and I'm absolutely thrilled to have one of my very favorite hockey players and human beings with us today. Worked for the Minnesota Wild, so I get the chance to watch practice once in a while with this guy over at Tria Rink. He is Mike Madonna. He needs no introduction to hockey fans here in the state of hockey. Mike, first off, welcome to Wooden Sticks.
Thanks, Kevin. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what's it like now, all these years later, from those glory days with the North Stars on to winning the Cup with Dallas, to be a part of the Minnesota Wild organization and to work with Billy Guerin? For the listeners out there that maybe aren't familiar, what is exactly your role and how much have you enjoyed it?
Well, to start from the start, it's just kind of funny how life works its way out and you end up in a place that you never thought would possibly happen after you've left it, you know, 35 something years ago. So, I mean, to become full circle and to have our family back here and raising our kids and being a part of the community and the fabric of Minnesota again, it's been really, you know, one of the fastest years we've had in a long time. But yeah, it's great to be back. And, you know, obviously a little bit of that reasoning of coming back was, you know, the involvement with the Wild. And my position there is kind of a pretty open-ended. I think I just have the ability to kind of be around. Obviously, you know, I was there before when we were interviewing. It's going on 5 or 6 years now already. So I've been interviewing those GMs before, after Paul Fenton was let go. So I was part of that process with Craig Leopold and Matt Maka trying to find a new GM. And so that was a interesting introduction to being a part of management and everything else, and how they weed through all those resumes and everybody that called and didn't realize I had so many friends after they found out I was part of that process. So everybody kind of came out of the woodwork wanting to just have an interview or a phone call of some sort. And, you know, so it kind of worked into this scenario where we ultimately, you know, narrowed in on Billy. And obviously our history goes way back and playing with each other for Olympic teams and World Cup and a few years in Dallas. And obviously our great rivalries that we had with Edmonton during those playoff years. And so, you know, a lot of respect for him, what he's done after hockey and staying involved and working up to GM. So, you know, I like to be involved. I just like to be around. I like to be around the guys, the players, the coaches, Billy, obviously, and just be a part of that day to day. And I get to watch practice every day with you.
And it's fun watching. I got to tell you, we're going to get to Kirill Kaprizov in just a moment. But I think the GM position is so important, and you've won a cup. So you probably have a different perspective than most of us here at Wooden Stick. So that presence that Bill Guerin has, the experience he brings to the table, having been involved as a player and assistant general manager, winning, I think it's a handful of Stanley Cups. How much does that matter when you're matriculating through all the different jobs that he has as general manager, negotiating contracts, being in the locker room with the guys, calling them out like he did this year when they were going through a tough time, having to make a coaching change. How much does that experience matter in your eyes?
I think it works. It goes a long, long way. I think in Billy's case, being a player and winning and being part of management and winning, I think he, you know, obviously there's an understanding of what it takes to put it together, a championship type team, the type of characters you have to have, the personalities, you know, the talent, the chemistry you need to create. And then having the right coach to kind of push all the right buttons there to kind of bring it all together. So there's a lot of moving parts there. And for a GM to kind of, you know, I guess, handle the hockey ops and handle a lot of the different, you know, categories behind the scenes with the other departments of the Wild. And so just having an open door, he's very personable. Obviously, he's very easy to talk to and, you know, loves to have a good time. But, you know, when he has to get prepared and be ready and push guys hard and be in people's faces and the coaches to kind of get a little bit more out of them, he's not too shy to do that, too. So, you know, he has the pedigree. He's won. So obviously he has a little bit of clout with what he says is carried a long way. So that I guess, you know, in a sense that just helps out a ton for when you're talking to players and, you know, there's no real backlash. Well, you know, in the player's back of his mind, well, he's never won. He, you know, no players can say that when Billy's kind of confronting anybody, you know, so there is a stigma to, you know, those championships that has that holds a higher clout over than everybody else. So you have to buy in or, you know, you might be moved out of here.
Yeah, I love my time around Bill Guerin and watching him around the rink with the guys. And I feel that presence and I know the history. So I do think it matters. I'm so glad you validated that opinion. When I talk to people about what I watched, when I watched young Mike Modano at the Met Center in Bloomington and then all the way through your career, I try to compare to a modern day player that maybe younger people can identify with. And I always come back to Connor McDavid because he's one of the rare players like you that when you had the puck, you could skate at full speed and still make plays. It's very difficult, especially in the National Hockey League, to make plays at full speed. You were that guy. So now I'm going to flip it around. When you watch Kirill Kaprizov, and he's an elite player, and he's an unbelievable talent for the Minnesota Wild, is there a player, Mike, that maybe back in the era of the early 90s all the way through maybe the early 2000s that you either played with or against that Kirill Kaprizov maybe reminds you of that guy?
Oh boy. You know, I got to go with a lot of their countrymen. You know, those guys just were so strong and so gifted and so, you know, ahead of the time and ahead of the game with the way they skated and how they controlled their speed in and out of corners and maintaining some strength and some stride at the same time. I mean, I look at, you know, Pavel Bure, I look at Fedorov, McGillney, you know, these guys could do good things at a full speed. And I think that's kind of one thing that, you know, was always in my back of my mind is like, you know, there's always fast skaters. There's a ton of guys who can get up and down that ice fast. But I think once you throw a puck in a situation and they have to carry the puck, there's a little bit of a, you know, a downshift there where, you know, they're more worried about control and possession of the puck. And, you know, so I was real adamant about everything I did in practice, you know, whether or not we got skated or bagged or all our skating drills, I always did it with a puck. I just felt like that was kind of the separation that I could get with the puck from defenders. You know, a lot like, you know, Connor or McKinnon or Kirill, you know, these guys can get some space and not lose a step once they have possession. And that was a big proponent of mine to be really good at. You know, it drove the coaches, drove Hitchcock nuts and Gainey nuts that, you know, they pushed all the pucks away from me, but, you know, I'd go find one. And I mean, that was just kind of my deal. I wanted to find out, you know, how quick I could get with the puck because everybody's fast without it.
It's fascinating because I had never seen that in all my years. I've coached, I've played, I've been around the game. I've never seen anybody that did those conditioning drills with a puck. And, you know, it feels like it makes total sense because I watched you play in games and I saw what you were able to do And I look at Connor McDavid as kind of the modern day version of your game. And I also see the comparison to Pavel Bure, the creativity. And what's thrown me, and I've been taken aback, is the work ethic that Kirill brings. And I know in our conversations at practice throughout each winter, you're out there. You see, this guy doesn't want to leave the rink. Like, there are most days where the rink guys have to come out and say, listen, we've got a college team coming out here. You know, we got to clear the ice. You have to leave. This is rare. Like, this kid isn't 19 years old anymore, and they have to drag him off the ice, Mike. That has to be a good thing for everybody involved in the organization when your best player is your hardest worker.
Yes, it's amazing. And that's just kind of, it shows you, you know, in the back, you know, in the heart of heart with games, it's always still a kid's game, and you go out there and just mess around, and it's just, you know, you have fun and, you know, you enjoy the moment. You know, so it's really enlightening to see, you know, players when they have that type of approach to the game. And Kirill is just like that. I mean, he gets out there early. He loves the drills. He loves the work. He loves to get better, push himself. He stays out after, and just, you know, there's a constant, you know, push to excel and just get to a level, you know, that not many people can get to. So it's enlightening to see. I mean, I think, you know, the European work ethic, I think the Russian work ethic is something I never really saw too much of until I had some teammates from those countries. And I was like, wow, these guys are animals in the gym. They work out hard. They're on the ice. They just constantly working at their craft. So I was like, wow. I mean, and, you know, it was more so, I mean, Datsuk was one of them in Detroit. I couldn't believe this guy's work ethic in practice, and some of the other guys that, you know, I got to play with, Yuri Ledman, Sergei Zubov. I mean, we would stay out afterwards forever, and you know, it's still a kid's game. You love it, you know, and you get upset, and you got the lip pout when they tell you you got to get off the ice because you got to get the next game out there, practice, or whoever's got the ice next. So. Yeah, it's short lived. It goes fast. So I was like, you know, I was always, you know, reminded of that from older players that, you know, enjoy it when you're out there and just have fun, you know, enjoy it. It goes fast. And, you know, and they were exactly right.
Well, let's go back to where it all started. You grew up in Michigan. What stoked the fire for young Mike Modano to just come to the game of hockey?
You know, it's funny, it's through some friends of my dad's. My dad was in construction in the business, building homes. And there was these three brothers that would come back in the summertime from school that lived in Detroit, very close to where I grew up. They would come work on the projects with my dad and earn some extra money in the summertime before going back to, school. And one of them played actually semi-pro hockey in Fort Wayne back in the day. And the other two were playing at college. So, yeah, I think at some point I'd go to projects with my dad and just hang around there on the weekends or off days of school and just kind of hang around and help build these homes. But these guys were big hockey fans. And so, I didn't really know anything about it. I hadn't been skating at all or even introduced to the game. And so I was getting a little bit of trouble here and there in school and trying to find some type of release of energy and some hyperactive tension I had as a kid, I guess. And, you know, so these guys were always telling my dad, you got to take them skating. You got to get them to hockey. Just take them once, see what happens. You know, I think so finally my dad gave in and we went there one time and that was it. I mean, I that day, that particular moment, I mean, I remember it as clear as day that I walked in there and, you know, we rented, bought some used gear in the pro shop and went out there and that was it. I mean, I was just hooked from that moment on. So it's just kind of weird how that happened. Otherwise, I don't think I would have ever been even, entertained that the chance of going skating or playing hockey. So that was just barely turning 8 years old, 7, 8 years old at that time. And so then that was it, you know, a couple of years of house hockey. And then I got into Squirt, played a little bit of travel, and then I got introduced to the whole Little Caesars program. And then from that on at 9 years old till 15, after I left for Prince Albert, it was, you know, 6 years of Little Caesars hockey. And, you know, there was, you know, just fabulous coaches. You know, we were, you know, with having Mike Ilitch and the Red Wings behind us and sponsors and this and that. So we were really lucky as players to have that type of support system from them. So, and then it just, escalated from there.
You didn't know it at the time, but you were going to make your NHL debut as a teenager. You were going to be 18 years old playing in the National. So at what age, Mike, did you realize maybe the light bulb went on where you thought, wait a minute, I'm actually pretty good here. I could end up being in the NHL. Was there a point as a teenager growing up where that kind of became a reality for you?
It was probably towards my tail end of my last year of midget in Detroit. And then my first year in Prince Albert, I went up there just, to get away. I was a few years younger to get recruited by college. I probably would have went to Michigan State and done that with Ron Mason. Mm-hmm. And, so I was kind of in this limbo, for a couple of years where, now they got the U.S. development program, they got the USHL. So there's these little pockets of things that kind of eat up some years there between making that decision, either juniors or college, which we didn't have back then. So, ultimately I just said, I'm going to do the junior route and, was planning to go to Quebec, and that fell through the night before the draft. And so Rick Wilson called me up about a week later and asked if I wanted to come see Prince Albert. And I was like, I'll come see it and I'll stay. I just packed everything I had and took off without even seeing the city. So I just knew that I needed to go there and just figure out, what that all entailed and what that looked like. And, so after my first year of juniors, then the rumors and everything got talking about, because you're in Canada, you're in the hotbed of hockey. So, every city you travel to, there's talk about it. And then our World Juniors in 87 in Moscow came back, and they had the Central Scouting Bureau came out with their ratings. And I was like, me and Trevor Linden were like 1 and 2. I was like, that just blew my mind. I'm like, wow, this is kind of like really going to be a interesting next half year of my junior career, my second year in junior. So it kind of led up to that. So there was like this back and forth, kind of who's going one, who's going two, all the way up until June. And then Lou made the announcement in Montreal, which we didn't know at the time which way he was going to go.
And I want to talk about that because it's the Montreal Forum. And for those that are listening that don't understand this, think of Yankee Stadium for baseball. The Montreal Forum is where it starts and begins in terms of the history of the National Hockey League, the original six, the old Montreal Canadiens, all the Stanley Cups. 1988, the draft is in Montreal. You mentioned Trevor Linden, Jeremy Roenick, Teemu Selanne, Rod Brind'Amour. These are the names that are being bantered about along with Mike Modano. What was that entire experience like? You end up being the first overall pick in the draft at the Montreal Forum. It had to be a remarkable experience.
Yeah. I mean, the whole month of June was really kind of a whirlwind. We had, we just got done with school. I had braces, so I just got my braces off. I just turned 18 June 7th. I got my braces off, I think, June 5th or 6th. So I had 2 years of braces up there playing junior hockey. And so guys loved that I had braces on my face. They would just rub my face with their gloves. And I mean, the braces didn't feel too good on the lips, but, so June 7th, my birthday, and then off to the draft, June 17th, 18th, I think it was, in Montreal. And then, I had my prom, June 25th back in Prince Albert. So it was a lot of boom, boom, boom. But, the Montreal, experience was just amazing because, we had the three top guys were from the Western Hockey League, and, you had Rod Brind'Amour, Teemu Selanne, Jeremy Roenick. We had a good little crop of guys that came out of there in that round. So, it was quite the experience. And, Lou, he had a poker face. He didn't really let anybody of us know what was going on, Trevor or myself, and which was kind of neat. Nowadays you just know who's going number one, where he's going. There's really no buildup to it. I think Lou just, he kind of played it well, and he kind of let it to be a surprise. And, it was kind of neat that he did it that way.
And you end up making your debut later in 1988, as I mentioned, as an 18-year-old. How did you adjust? Because, you know, I look back at that year in my life. I was playing in the USHL in Des Moines for the Buccaneers, and it was a really hard transition for me, Mike. Now, you had been away from home. You mentioned the path that you took, but this is a whole different world when you're Mike Modano and the first pick in the draft and you're in Minnesota, a very hockey-centric market. How did you adjust, and what were those first few months like as a pro?
I mean, they were tough. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of adjustments. I mean, the catch 22 of going first, you're going to the worst team in the league. So you have, you have a lot of repairing to do, some changing, some personnel, there were some coaches, some ownership there that happened, everything else in the first couple of years that I was there. Ultimately it was a lot of big players. They're strong, they're fast. I mean, you just didn't have the time and space that you felt like you had in juniors. And then, you know, when you're not able to do what you were picked to do, and for them, it was very frustrating, to the point you really start getting down on yourself, and you know, your confidence kind of wavers a lot. There was glimpses of it here and there. So I guess I had moments of thinking, oh, okay, this, you know, I could work through this and get this, and I could have this happen for me in here, and, you know, timely goals and certain plays that happened along the way, my first, second year, I remember. And, which helped alleviate some of that. So, you're kind of thrust in there, and I had some great guys around me and teammates that just kind of knew that, you know, they helped, alleviate some of that. It's a big growing pain because it was, you know, the travel, you know, we still flew commercial back then for, yep, you know, up until 1996 or 97. So, you know, commercial flights, time to practice was in essence. So every time we flew back to Minnesota, bus over to Metroplex, the Met Center, and have practice. And, you know, so there's a big adjustment just to the travel, the size, the speed of the game. It took a few years to catch up.
Well, and a few years later, for all of us that are Minnesota hockey fans, this is a magical time in our lives, and it, no one saw it coming. I'll be the first to admit I certainly didn't. 1991, you guys finished the regular season with 68 points, one of the teams towards the bottom. And you mentioned it, you were the first pick in the draft, so you guys were kind of building from the bottom up. But in 1991, you had some good hockey players outside of yourself. I remember Neil Broughton. I remember Dave Gagne, Mark Tenorti, Sean Chambers. You had John Casey, your goaltender, who's got some Minnesota connections. So you guys get done with the regular season, and back then it's 1-16. And so now you're taking on the President's Trophy winner, the Chicago Blackhawks, a hated rival for all of us here in North Star country. What's the game plan? Like, what that week leading up to the playoffs, or those couple of days as you map out a plan, how do you guys go from a team with 68 points to a team that's going to have a chance against Chicago and the other top teams in the Western Conference?
I think we really didn't have an idea of how that was going to play out. I think Bob, Gainey prepared us as much as possible, just trying to get some type of game plan put together, how we were going to match up, particularly with certain players. But we just knew that, you know, how we were going to go against, you know, Belfour or Chelios, and I think Michel Goulet was still there, Steve Larmer, Dirk Graham. They just had a roster like no other that was just crazy skilled and tough. And, you know, Chicago Stadium was just a hard place to play. Mike Keenan behind the bench, Dave Manson. So it was just a real, on paper, it didn't look good for us against these guys. So we just felt, you know, let's get into this first game and see how it goes. But I think what we never realized what would happen would be that the frustration level on Chicago just was off the charts. They just thought, you know, this should be over in four. These guys shouldn't be even in the playoffs to begin with. So, I mean, they just came after us and just took liberty and ran us and hit us and, you know, cross check slash. I mean, and then they ended up being in the penalty box. And then we just hit this groove with our power play that I had never seen probably to this day. I think, you might fact check it, but I think we still have the most power play goals in a playoff run to this day still. More than the Edmonton Oilers or Pittsburgh Penguins, I think we still have the most power play goals in one playoff season from 1991 year. And that just frustrated them even more because every time we were on it, we scored. And they get more mad and take more penalties. We'd score again. So this was kind of our MO, I guess, or our, you know, our saving grace or our little God above us that, you know, we started our power play just was clicking like no other. We just had a couple units. Brian Propp was out there, Gagne, Neil Broughton, and Tenorti. Tenorti was working the front of the net, and you know, Neil and I or were working the points and with Chambers, and you know, Dave and Brian Propp were just, and Brian Bellows was right in there. You know, so it frustrated him to all hell, and we ended up on every series that we played, we started on the road and we ended up winning that first game on the road. So right then we have the split, we feel confident going back home to the Met Center. And then that place was just on a slow boil from game to game, round to round, that place just started going crazy. And then, you know, we didn't lose our first home game till, oh man, I think it was game five maybe, or game four against Pittsburgh in the finals. So it was just a magical, I mean, you know, never, no one ever would have envisioned this, and it probably would never happen ever again to that point.
And it's funny you bring up the frustration thing, because I've seen an interview with one of your teammates, Brian Bellows, and he talked about early in that series how at a couple of the faceoffs in either game one or two in Chicago at the old stadium, how Dirk Graham basically was taunting him at the faceoff, saying, I don't know why you guys are working so hard. It's going to be a short series. You have no chance of winning this series. Why don't you just go away? And Bellows made a point to bring it up a couple times in this particular interview that Dirk Graham and some of the Blackhawks were like almost ridiculing you guys for how hard you were working early in the series, knowing that it was just a futile effort and you had no chance to win. I'm certain that when you got back to Minnesota, you talk about that slow boil. I was in the Met Center for every single one of your home games through that entire playoff run. And I will tell you, when that building got going, you felt it. And it was a very, very loud building. How much do you think that maybe played a part in maybe Chicago taking some of those penalties and maybe knowing that, my God, this isn't going to be four or five games. We're going to have to figure out a way to adjust. And by the time they tried to adjust, it was too late.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, you know, before they could get a handle on trying to change their game plan or think about, you know, trying to play us different, you know, we're up, you know, 2-1 or 3-1 or 3-2. And, you know, we just knew that back home, we just were as solid as ever. And the crowd was going crazy. It just, you know, that building was just one of those, you know, those small, intimate buildings. I think it, you know, if I remember, it was only like 15,000 maybe in there. And so it tended to get loud. I mean, it was just had that feel to it. I remember in 91 that year, that winter, I went to a Motley Crue concert, and I'm like, this rink sounds like there's 100,000 people in here listening to Motley Crue. It was so loud, that concert. And I was like, God, it reminded me, you know, I go back to those playoff games. I mean, I'd sit on the bench, I'm looking at Brian, I said, I can't even hear you talk. I'm like, I'm trying to discuss something to him. I'm a foot from his face, and I'm just yelling at him. And it was just like, you know, there's only a few buildings that reminded me of that loud. It was like Edmonton, I mean, Met Center in 91, I think Dallas, obviously 99. And obviously a weird one is San Jose, the Shark Tank. That place would get so loud that we just look at each other. We can't hear each other talk. And the Met was just like that. And there was just a snowball that's just started happening. It just went on and on. And for us, we were playing loose. There's no expectations. I mean, we just had a god awful year. I think we won the last one or two games in the season to get in, and then that, you know, the rest was, you know, just, it just kind of rolled and rolled, and you know, we never would imagine what happened.
Well, in round two, again, people forget, like, Chicago had this record breaking year where they had 100-some points. They were much the best for the President's Cup, but the team that was in second chased them down into the final week. St. Louis finished just a couple points behind them, led by Brett Hull. And what I remember about that series in round two against St. Louis, and I mentioned you guys had talent. I mean, between you and Neil Broughton and Bellows and Gagne, I mean, there were some good high-end players on your hockey club. But I think what made your team, as that playoff run kind of unfolded before our eyes, a difficult team to beat, is you had some really solid role players like Gaetan Duchesne and Stuart Gavin. And I look back at that series, Mike, against St. Louis, and I have never seen a more frustrated hockey player than Brett Hull. Bob Gainey instrumented a plan that you don't really see much anymore in the National Hockey League, but there was nowhere that Brett Hull could go where one of those two guys literally wasn't on his hip, like right in his pocket. How much do you remember about that series and what you guys were able to do to Brett Hull?
Well, that was the other thing. I forgot to make that point. Like, Bob just kind of, he told Stu, Gavin, and Duchesne, I mean, and they did it a little bit in Chicago with Larmer and I guess Roenick and some of their high-scoring guys at the time. But it really became evident in St. Louis' series where, you know, these two guys were on Brett the whole series. I mean, he couldn't move. And we knew Adam Oates was, you know, he could find a seam, he could find, you know, thread a needle, but, you know, he wouldn't shoot very often. So if we took away his options from the power play and from Hulley, you know, our odds were pretty good in that sense. So Bob's game plan was just basically take him away, try to keep it 5-on-5 as much as possible. And we just kind of, they just shut him down. I mean, I don't think he got any goals or, you know, not many points at all or many shots even to the net. So, I mean, they did an unbelievable job of just shutting him down. And, you know, so that was the start of that, really that clamped down type style that we had from those particular two guys. But yeah, we just had some role guys that would chip in. Mark Burrow was there on the fourth line center. He was a good little penalty killer, right-handed, good faceoff kid. God, I'm just trying to go through the line, but we just
Ulf
had
Dahlin
guys,
had that kind of, yeah.
Ulfie Dahlin was just guys at different times were just chipping in. And, the main guys had a phenomenal, playoffs. Gags, you know, Dave was great with Brian Propp. Those two were really good together. You know, Neil obviously and Bellows, you know, so there was, you know, we had a good mix of good defensive guys and offensive guys who played well without the puck too. So, I mean, that was a big difference for us too.
So you beat Chicago, you beat St. Louis, and your reward for beating the top two teams during the regular season is to face the defending Stanley Cup champions, the Edmonton Oilers. And I got to tell you, there was some drama in those first two series. There wasn't much drama in this series. You guys ended this thing in 5 games. Your confidence at that point, Mike, had to be sky high.
Yeah, it was phenomenal that we walked into Edmonton and, you know, obviously we split there and then we went home and won both in Minnesota. So, yeah, I mean, 3-1 going back to Edmonton, we thought, you know, we just, you know, put these guys out of their misery. Don't let them back into it. If it goes 3-2, you never know. They could always just come back and just have someone could have a miraculous showing in Game 6 in Minnesota. Then you got to go back to, you know, Nassau for Game 7, which would have been a real tough game for us to play. But man, we just kind of controlled their speed and, you know, kind of eliminated Messier and Glenn Anderson. I mean, Paul Coffey, we got to Grant Fuhr quite often. And I think still they were a little bit like Chicago where they were kind of, you know, getting frustrated, starting to take penalties. And, you know, we were starting to, you know, still kick it in gear with our power play. So that was a combination of that. So, but yeah, it looked like they were running out of gas. They just looked tired as that series went on. And Bobby Smith, I forgot yeah. Smitty. He was playing
the big one there.
Yeah,
I forgot too.
And you know, he had a great series against Edmonton. And you know, so yeah, it was just no one would have thought 5 games, but you know, that was done faster than we thought any of the other ones would be for sure.
You get to the Cup final and you follow the exact same template. You get the win in game 1, you lose game 2. That's exactly how the other series had gone. You come home, you win game 3. The place is going bananas. I mean, Minnesota was on fire in 1991. I'm not kidding. And so we all come back for game 4. And I'll never forget it, Mike, because The Penguins come out and literally score three goals in the first 6 minutes. It's 3-0 Pittsburgh, and the building's dead quiet. But you guys found your magic. You found your mojo. Ends up being a fantastic game. Bottom line is, it comes down to the wire. And I believe it's 4-3 in the third period. And your teammate, Neil Broughton, one of my very favorite Minnesota hockey players of all time, had two or three just unbelievable chances. One missed the net. One Tom Barrasso just robbed him on. How much do you remember about that game? Because that was the one time the template didn't continue. You didn't get the 3-1 lead, and that seemed to flip that Stanley Cup final upside down, and Pittsburgh kind of took over from there.
Yeah, it did. I want to say game three. I don't think Lemieux played game three. I think he was starting to have some back issues. He missed game three. And so then he came back for obviously 4, 5, and 6 and was just a men among boys at that point for those three games. But I know we scratched and clawed to get back to there. And I recall those opportunities for Neil that were right there. So, I mean, man, if one of them goes in, you go to overtime or something, then, you know, you just never know what happens. But yeah, I think we felt that there was a little bit of a shift happening there. Mario was starting to feel a little bit better. And, then that was history. So he was just off the charts in game five in Pittsburgh, where he split Wilkinson and Chambers there and alone and Casey and made that unbelievable play. Then game six, we like to forget, but it was just you could start seeing the air coming out of the balloon in game four. So it was once we didn't get that one, we thought, God, that would have gave us a real big cushion at least to come back to game five or six with an opportunity to win. It would have been if you knew the Stanley Cup was in the Met Center in game six, the place would have probably went bonkers.
There's no way. If you had a lead, there was no way you were going to lose game six. I was in the building for that clinching game with my buddies, and it was an 8-0 game. You mentioned we all want to forget it, but early in the third period, the building was starting to empty out. My buddies got up to leave, and I said, guys, I know this sucks. I know it's not going to be any fun to watch the clock count down on our team, but I've never seen the cup with my own eyes. And so we sat there and kind of moved down closer to the plexiglass just to see the Stanley Cup. And none of us at that time had any idea what was going to happen. Now we fast forward, Mike, to 1993. For all of us in Minnesota, it's still a wound that probably will never completely heal. But for you guys as players, I look at what Arizona's going through right now, and they're likely moving to Salt Lake City. I don't think people understand what a big deal that is, like to uproot a franchise. And for you guys as players, and you were still pretty young at this point, what was 1993 like, and what was the move to Dallas like for you as a hockey player?
When you look back at it now, it was very difficult. I think you when you're young and looking at it, it's like, you know, what ultimately would have happened to make this kind of deal fall through where you actually have to move the North Stars out of Minnesota. I guess being 22, 23 or 4 at the time, I didn't understand what was, you know, what that entailed, you know, what was the determining factors of us staying or leaving. Looking back at it now and understanding what it was, it just seems so ridiculous that it wasn't worked out in some way, shape or form, that, you know, there wasn't some type of agreement put in place to, you know, kind of, you know, stay at the Met, play another year or two there or three, see what happens, and then work something out maybe with, you know, either upgrading the Met or working something out at the Target Center where you kind of shared a venue with the Timberwolves. I just feel like there was so many other options or scenarios that could have played out than the one that did ultimately happen. So I guess that was the frustrating part. And the other thing was the change of the uniforms. Once that happened in, I think, 92, 93, they got rid of the N. I was like, man, these new ones were just god awful. Just terrible design. And I actually live with the family I live with in Minnesota, Bill Mack. He was part of that design group that helped Norm Green do that. So I was like, I give Bill crap to this day. I was like, how can you come up with that and get rid of the N and the color, the green and everything else? you know, but I guess that was really the sign of what was to come, where that neutral Stars name or logo or whatever it was could be easily traveled and moved anywhere. And that was the case. So it was shocking to get, you know, our invite to training camp in the summer, that it was going to be in Dallas. And so we're all in the same way as Coyotes. You know, now we're scrambling to get down to Dallas, find a place to live. Guys were trying to find schools and places for kids and get situated. The training staff has to find a rink. The rink wasn't suitable, so they had to do a ton of upgrades in a matter of a month to kind of get it ready for us for training camp. So there was a lot of moving parts, and then have to upgrade Reunion downtown where the Mavericks were playing at the time. So it was just, you know, an overnight thing that you didn't really have time to really kind of sit and digest what just happened until you're like, wow, we're really going to Dallas and this is it. It's still mind blowing to this day when we talk about it.
Yeah, it's still hard to believe. And I lived through it. We went without a hockey team for many years and it's all worked out fine. You know, the Wild are here now and they're our club. We had to watch our old team, your team, win the Stanley Cup in 1999. I'll have to tell you that was bittersweet because we were happy for a lot of the players that were originally North Stars like you. I think of watching some of those games against Buffalo. But for you personally, how much did that cup run as a young guy, as a 21-year-old in 1991? How much did that help you as a leader and as kind of the focal point of the team in 1999 make that run to eventually win the cup this time?
Well, it was a good learning experience. I think you really kind of got taught how hard it is to really get to where you have to go to win. And I think being so young and naive, you really don't maybe understand the magnitude of what's happening. And maybe that is to a good point. You don't understand. You just go out there and play and, you know, stay loose and have fun. You know, I think as you got older, you start realizing, man, this getting to the playoffs is even hard and getting through four rounds is hard. You know, so, I mean, the first thing I said after that, I was like, God, I can't wait to do this next year. I was like, you know, we hadn't come close for, you know, another 8-9 years after that. So, but yeah, it was hard because, you know, I felt after we left and went to Dallas, we started building a team that could have been just, you know, was a phenomenal team. And, you know, I think the people here would have just ate that team up. I mean, this place would have been going crazy with the type of runs we had there and obviously winning a couple of another Stanley Cup final in 2000, but, you know, three or four Western Conference championships, some divisions. So it would have been, you know, it would have been just an amazing, you know, place to be here in Minnesota for that, you know, those 7-8 year runs that we had. But yeah, I mean, as then 99 comes, you know, you're still 29, 28 at the time. And, you know, so you try to think back to what you went through in 91, but, you know, the game had changed a lot. It was very much, much more physical and faster than it was in 91. You know, so, and it was just, you know, a lot more pressure, I think, and then, you know, going into it. So I think mentally and physically it was just a very grueling, demanding. I think the patience in the organization with me was kind of getting to a point where, you know, it's been 10 years with the team. Not much had happened since 91. So I didn't know how much more time I had with them as far as staying around and maybe them thinking that, you know, maybe Mike wasn't the answer that we could get or take us to a championship or something. But, you know, lucky for me, they hung in there and stuck with me. And then we had Hitchcock come in. And then I think once Ken came in and took over, I think my career changed, you know, my way of approaching the game changed. And, you know, ultimately we got some good pieces in there with us and we won. So, but yeah, it was a real demanding series. And, you know, you just physically, I mean, man, you can't realize it until you go through it that, you know, this is a hard championship to win.
So after you win the cup, what's maybe the one memory to this day that still stands out after you win the cup? Was it your day with the cup? Was it a parade? Was there a moment after you win that that Stanley Cup that, that you look back and it just makes you smile when you have that memory?
God, I just feel it like it was the moment right after Brett scored. And I mean, I was just elated. There was a wave of emotions, being relieved that it was over, obviously won, but that we had won, that, you know, now we just have that one that, you know, this is, you know, ultimately, you know, you feel a little bit of contentment saying, you know, God, I got it finally. This is it, you know, and I was just hysterically crying for God, I don't know how long after that puck went in the net and guys were just trying to hold me up. And, you know, after a while, you know, Hitch grabs me. He's like, shake out of it. You know, get over it. Stop it. You know, we won, you know, relax. And, you know, so I was just crying for so long. I was like, man, this was just, you know, the weight of the world just felt like it just kind of just drained out of me. And, you know, I had broke my wrist in game two. So I didn't know if I was going to play, you know, so we were numbing that up to no end just to kind of get through those nights. And so just to have it over with, I was like, oh, I just want to just lay around and do nothing forever. And, but yeah, I mean, it was the flight home from Buffalo. You know, we got home around 7 a.m. We met all our family and friends at a hotel for brunch. And then, you know, that was just, we went home to bed finally. And then what was weird is like Tom Hicks had the cup in Dallas for about 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks after it, which was very uncommon. Usually, it, you know, you have, you know, you take it home and it goes to Toronto. It comes back for the parade and then it goes back to start making the routes for the summertime visits. But it stayed in town for 2 weeks. And, you know, somehow, some way, you know, he had all these affairs set up during the day at his businesses, his companies. But somehow he would end up with it at night. And it was 2 weeks of that. I was like, after 2 weeks, I was like, I don't even want to see this thing ever again. Cause I felt like I was just going to be, exhausted for another year just from those 2 weeks. So it was just bedlam in town. We just took it everywhere. You know, every guy would just, you know, we'd take it to the hospitals. We'd take it to golf courses. We took it to restaurants, our friends, you know, we just were all over the place in a matter of 2 weeks. And I think we were in every bar in Dallas and Fort Worth. And so it was just a complete blowout for 13, 14 days. And then, you know, we were like, God, take this thing back to Toronto.
Oh, that's awesome. Some of my favorite, like when I watch Stanley Cup finals, some of my favorite memories as a fan are just seeing the faces and the tears and the emotion. And you speak to it here. You know, if a kid ever gets to the point where they think they can be a National Hockey League player, it's the absolute pinnacle of what every kid dreams of, is grabbing that trophy. And being that you've had a chance to do that, the emotion involved with it, just to hear that again today just makes me smile. We've come to the final segment, Mike, of our show. You've been amazing. I haven't even covered half my notes that I had for this interview today. You're so good at what you do. I just love hearing these stories. So we've come to the hat trick hot seat. These are three just fun questions, just to kind of get, there's no wrong answer, to close our little conversation out. We'll start with this one. The best concert you ever attended in your life, the venue and the band.
Best concert I've ever attended. Oh my God, that's a tough one. I did mention Metallica in 91.
Yeah, I mean, sounds like a pretty good concert.
Motley Crue in 91, I think, at the Met Center. The other one that I recall that I had the best time was Ozzy Osbourne at Target Center with we're in a suite with Scott Erickson, Chuck Knobloch, myself, boy, Rich Gannon. And we got down afterwards to take pictures with Ozzy. And it was like, I think that was like 92 as well, 93 or sometime. And we just had a ball. Those guys were so fun. Scott and Chuck were great friends, and Rich, of course. So I recall that Ozzy one really well.
That's a great pick. Next would be, if we go back in the time machine and we're going to go back to 1991, and you're a 21-year-old Mike Modano, and you can go back for one night tonight to a Twin Cities restaurant or bar, as the 21-year-old Mike Modano out there, the rock star that I knew you were because I was at a lot of the same bars you were back in that era. I remember Joe Sensors in Bloomington bumping into you guys there after some of your games at the Met. If you could go back in time tonight for one night as a 21-year-old, which bar or restaurant in the Twin Cities are you going to?
Oh, my God. I know where I'd be in Saturday afternoon would probably be Fletcher's on Minnetonka.
That works. Sure.
That would be a for sure go thing. But at night, oh, man, 21 at night. Oh, God. Oh, 7th Ave was a lot of fun.
Yes.
But one spot we'd always go to, Loon Cafe, and I think it's still open. Isn't it down there? Yeah, yep. I mean, that was just...
Great pick.
Great spot. So, you know, that was another one. Jose in the Alley, which was right next door to it before you got to the
Turnpike. I love that alleyway. Oh, that was so cool out there.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, you said so. Sensors was a great spot. But a real quick funny story. We went to Gianni's for dinner in Minnetonka here, Wayzata, about a month ago with my family and stuff. And the waiter starts coming up to me, and he's looking at me. He's like, God. He goes, Mike... Is that you, Mike? I was like, yeah. I go, and I'm looking at this guy like, I know this guy. I'm like, I picture this guy's face. I've seen it, you know, 100 times somewhere. And he goes, you won't remember this, but, you know, and I said, I probably will if you know, explain it. He goes, well, you used to come into Chili's on Highway 100 after all your games with the North Stars, and I would be your waiter. And I was like, my God, this guy would – And I wouldn't forget him because that would be the place we could go. And this guy would bring out these red Solo cups for us to have a drink or something in them. And I'm like, I never forgot this guy's face or who it was. And he's like, and I saw him at Gianni's about 2 weeks ago. And I'm like, oh my God, 30 years ago.
That is a small world moment right there.
Yeah.
Holy cow. And I love Gianni's, by the way. That is a great spot for a steak. Final question, and we'll wrap it up. You're a golfer. You're a very good golfer. Your wife is a former pro golfer, and she's probably not listening. So you don't have to, if you don't want to put her in the foursome, I think we'll all understand it. But if you could go today to any golf course and bring any three golfers you want for a dream foursome of golf, what's the golf course and which three people are you bringing with, whether you know them or you don't know them? Who's your dream foursome today?
Oh, my God. Wow. Well, of course, Tiger.
Yes.
That's a no-brainer. I think the other two spots, oh, man. God. Wow.
That is, and some of these people you maybe have played with already. Unlike most of us mere mortals, you've probably played golf with some movie stars over the years.
Oh, God. I love Donnie Wahlberg. I throw Wahlberg in there.
Absolutely.
I know he's a big golfer. Would love that. With them, him, Tiger, Donnie. Oh, man. I don't know. It'd have to be another golfer or something. But, you know, maybe Arnold Palmer. I'd throw him in there. Yeah.
I don't think you ever go wrong with the king. Which course would you want to play?
Oh, man. We'd have to do the Masters, Augusta. Yeah,
got to go to Augusta.
Yep.
You can't go wrong with Tiger at Augusta along with Arnie.
Wouldn't be bad.
That'd be okay, and Wahlberg could bring some burgers. It'd be a great day, let me tell you. Mikey, thank you. Honestly, just going back in the time machine to that 91 run, I texted with you a couple days ago and mentioned that I had gone down the rabbit hole on YouTube, and you know my late dear friend who I got the chance to work with, Doug McLeod, calling the games, our mutual friend Lou Nanny doing color commentary. For all of us in Minnesota, it was a special time. And, you know, Minnesota is flyover country, and we get, you know, abused for our records of our teams over the years. But in 1991, we had the Stanley Cup, we had the World Series, and we had the Super Bowl. It was a pretty special time for all of us as sports fans. And as good as all those other events were, as I mentioned, I was in the barn for every one of those home games. And I just thought it was an unbelievable atmosphere, and it's something I'll never forget. So having those conversations with you today has been one of the highlights of my broadcast career. So thanks for doing this.
You got it, Kevin. Love talking with you. Thank you.
Oh man, that was a good time. I couldn't get the smile off my face. I was telling my producer Brandon here when we wrapped up that I had just a giant placard full of notes, and I covered maybe half of those notes. So hopefully we can have Mike back in the down the road here in the future, just because stories are compelling, they're interesting, and it takes a lot of us back to such a special time. 1991 for me as a Minnesota sports fan, it doesn't get much better. And I loved having the Super Bowl here, and the World Series was awesome. It was our second World Series for the Twins, but that cup run in 91 still stands out as a memory like none other because it came out of nowhere. And, between Bobby Smith and Neil Broughton and Mike Modano, they had star power and they had this grit. They had Bob Gainey behind the bench, the old Montreal Canadian. It was really a magical, magical ride to that cup final. And just hearing all the stories that Mike brought out today, it's the reason I wanted to do this show. It's the reason I wanted to call it Wooden Sticks. It's hockey. It's old school hockey. It's an opinion of mine that there's a nostalgic aspect to the game that is still special and sacred. And I loved hearing what Mike had to say about Kirill Kaprizov and comparing him to guys like Pavel Bure. And I think we're very spoiled in this day and age to have a superstar like Kirill. We haven't had many. And if you look at who the Wild have had, it's probably Marian Gabrick and now Kaprizov. And Kaprizov probably, with a bullet, the best ever in the history of the organization. If you look at the North Stars, there were some unbelievable players going back to Bill Goldsworthy, to Dino Cicerelli. I mentioned Neil Broughton, Bobby Smith. These are superstar players, but you'll be hard-pressed to find a better one than number 9, Mike Modano. And really, really enjoyed that chat today. And we'll hope to have some more of that North Star flavor here in the coming weeks on this program. Masonic Charities really appreciate their support along with Beta Bay Boat Club. And I'd love you to get involved, or maybe you know somebody that's got a business that needs to be elevated. The hockey community takes care of their own. That's one thing that's stood the test of time. And so we'd love to have you on Wooden Sticks or somebody you know's business. And Karen Cleary can make it happen. All you've got to do is send her a quick note, just a quick little email to K Cleary, KCLEARY, at talknorth.com, and be a part of the show. And maybe the next time we have a special guest like Mike Modano, we can elevate your business and bring more people to you. I'm Kevin Gorg. I appreciate you listening. This is Wooden Sticks. A special thank you to Mike Modano, the Hall of Famer, for being a part of the show today. And we look forward to more great guests right here on the Talk North Network in the weeks to come.